My name's Matt, one of the church staff, and let me add my welcome if you're here for the first time, you're visiting. Great to sing together, isn't it? Really good. Thank you, Piero and the band. Appreciate that. We're doing this summer series at the moment in our teaching slot on Sundays called Snapshots. We're looking at small and often ignored bits of the Bible and finding the gold inside them. As a church, we believe the Bible is this big, amazing love letter from God to the world. We take it seriously. So we're going to look at a tiny book this morning, but let me tell you first about the author because it sets the scene very helpfully for us. There he is. I think he's the one on the left. The author was a man called John. John would have been born early in the first century, probably in the Galilee region of northern Israel. Like most of the great people in the Bible, he was a northerner. Just throwing that out there. Factual. He's nobody special. He's just a normal Jewish bloke in a very religious country under Roman rule. And then he grows up and he becomes a fisherman, like all his mates. Very, very normal. And then when he's in his late teens, maybe early 20s, he meets this man called Jesus. And Jesus is different. His teaching is another level. It's richer. It's more challenging. It's more personal somehow. And he does miracles as well. And crowds start gathering around him. And it was normal for teachers like Jesus to grab a sort of little group of sidekicks called disciples. And John got to be one. And the crowds grow even more. Hundreds, there's thousands of people showing up. The Jesus thing gets bigger and bigger. But John is still, he's still in that inner circle. It's amazing. And then the leaders of the nation take notice. The Roman occupiers take notice. Jesus is controversial, but he carries on what he's doing. And it doesn't happen overnight. But John eventually comes to believe that his friend is God become a man. John ends up believing that. He knows it's crazy. Jewish people don't believe that. But he comes to believe it. And his mates do as well. It's not just him. And then things get even more serious. Jesus is arrested. And then he's crucified. And John is devastated. His closest friend, his mentor, the man he thought was God, is dead. Imagine. And then 3 days later, he sees him. At first, John thinks, oh, I must have gone mad. But then his mates and a bunch of other people see him too. It's amazing. And then he sees Jesus a number of times and he teaches John and the others about himself and what on earth is going on. Then Jesus leaves and John and his mates and a few hundred other people know this incredible truth. Jesus must be God. He must be the God they suspected him to be because he's beaten death. Nobody does that. And then over the next few years, the number of people who follow Jesus grows. In fact, it explodes. It's very exciting. And John even writes down what he saw Jesus do, and his words become what we now know as John's gospel, this amazingly influential text. More people get involved, the news spreads, it goes beyond Israel, it changes communities all around the world, but the stakes are high. A lot of the early Christians face great persecution, a lot of people get killed. It's serious stuff. Within a few decades, all of John's original gang of mates end up being executed, and he's the last one standing. It happens to everybody else. By around 85, 95 AD, John is maybe he's about 80, 90 years old, which for us, we would say that's a pretty good age. But in the ancient world, hardly anybody lived to be that old. So he was a big deal. He would have been considered a very, very, very old man. He's probably a little bit of a church celebrity. He's the bloke that met Jesus personally. He's the bloke that was there way back when. He knew Jesus really well. And by the time he writes what we're going to see today, he's a sort of wise and seasoned old man. He's still as passionate as he's ever been about Jesus, but he's matured as well. He knows what really matters when it comes to the crunch. This is not just somebody who hung out with Jesus and saw him die and rise again. That's amazing. But not only that, he's lived with the ripple effect of that for years. Years and years of his life. He's seen the church grow. He's seen the problems that normal people have. And as an old man, he writes some letters to various people and churches, three of which are in the Bible, the second of which we call 2 John, because the people that name letters in the Bible are not very creative. So it's just 2 John. 2 John's really, really short. It's 245 words. It's basically a postcard, but it reflects the wisdom and insight of an old man who was best friends with Jesus and has thought about it and lived with it for more than 50 years. Imagine that. Nobody else has ever been in that position, ever. That's what happened to John. So I'm going to read this little letter. Look out for what John is really concerned with in this letter. This letter is from John, the elder. He really was. I am writing to the chosen lady and to her children, whom I love in the truth, as does everyone else who knows the truth, because the truth lives in us and will be with us forever. Grace, mercy, and peace, which come from God the Father and from Jesus Christ, the Son of the Father, will continue to be with us who live in truth and love. How happy I was to meet some of your children and find them living according to the truth, just as the Father commanded. I'm writing to remind you, dear friends, that we should love one another. This is not a new commandment, but one we've had from the beginning. Love means doing what God has commanded us, and he's commanded us to love one another, just as you heard from the beginning. I say this because many deceivers have gone out into the world. They deny that Jesus Christ came in a real body. Such a person is a deceiver and an antichrist. Watch out you do not lose what we've worked so hard to achieve. Be diligent so that you receive your full reward. Anyone who wanders away from this teaching has no relationship with God. But anyone who remains in the teaching of Christ has a relationship with both the Father and the Son. If anyone comes to your meeting and does not teach the truth about Christ, don't invite that person into your home or give any kind of encouragement. Anyone who encourages such people becomes a partner in their evil work. I have much more to say to you, but I don't want to do it with paper and ink, for I hope to visit you soon and talk with you face to face. Then our joy will be complete. Greetings from the children of your sister, chosen by God. So that's the whole thing. That's the whole letter. And it seems to me, John was a bloke who really liked truth. He uses the word truth quite a lot. The word truth in our culture has come to mean a number of different things, hasn't it? Is the truth the facts? Is that what truth is? Is it all about my truth, my own beliefs and my feelings on a subject? Is the truth our friend? John actually draws a lot of these things together. There's one Greek word for truth that he uses, aletheia. Is aletheia here this morning? Someone in our church called aletheia. She's not here. That's the truth. But he uses the word in different ways. For John, truth is propositional, it's powerful, and it's personal. It's propositional, it's powerful, and it's personal. And we need all three. So firstly, it's propositional. And I apologize for the long word, but it does begin with a P, and I needed that. So you'll have to live with it. To say the truth is propositional means it's either true or it's false. It's about certainty. There's no in-between. It's like 3 + 3 = 6. I am taller than my wife. Becca doesn't need amplification to talk to people. These are just facts. There's no gray area. They are true regardless of how people feel about them, aren't they? And John believes that Christianity is true in that way. In fact, he lives by it. The first 5 verses are all about truth. He uses the word 5 times in those short verses. But even more than that, the whole second half of this letter that we just read is all about protecting the truth. Verse 10 is probably the clearest. If anyone comes to your meeting and does not teach the truth about Christ, don't invite that person into your home or give any kind of encouragement. It's pretty strong, isn't it? And it sounds harsh, but John's talking about at that time, there were religious teachers who would roam around and they'd go around the country and teach their ideas and they would stay with people for weeks and weeks at a time and they'd have a huge influence on a town, a village, a household. And they'd just turn up and nobody knew them. You couldn't check them out online. So John's saying, be careful who you endorse. Be careful whose messages you let into your life, into your household. The reason is, John has seen what goes on. Truth matters. What is true or not true about Jesus matters because what you believe about Jesus shapes everything else. It matters. John knew Jesus inside out. He saw him die. He saw him come back. And he's lived ever since in certainty about it through persecution, opposition, people saying he's crazy. John has weathered it all because he knows. He knows it's true. Some of us are more naturally drawn to propositional truth. We like facts. Evidence. We want to know all the right answers and get it right. We appreciate black and white. Some of us aren't drawn to that way of thinking at all, and that's fine. But John knows that behind everything, it matters that this is true. It matters that it's true. And I have to say, I've interacted in my life with hundreds of Christians, people of different ages, different stories, things that have gone on. But the ones who haven't engaged with the facts of their faith are often the ones that don't last the course. The ones who haven't engaged with it. In recent weeks, you may or may not be aware, there's been a few high-profile Christian figures, particularly in America, who've publicly come out and said, I'm not a Christian anymore. There's been a number of people who've done that. But you read their words and think about why. None of them ever come forward and say, well, I've done loads of research and I've disproved the resurrection. None of them ever comes and says, having engaged with the various expressions of the cosmological argument for God's existence, I've found them wanting. They never say that. They pretty much always say something along the lines of, some Christians let me down. That's basically the reason that they tend to give, these people. And you think, well, of course they did. The Bible could have told you. I could have told you that. You know, is that what your faith was built on, the niceness of Christians? I'm surprised it lasted more than a month. Maybe 6 weeks at Maybridge. Come on. Now, of course, you know, when life falls apart, when terrible things happen, when your faith is attacked, you've got to process the emotions. You've got to talk it through. That's very healthy. It's vital. But the people who come out the other side and maintain a strong faith, in my experience, are the ones who knew it was true in the first place. And that's why they believed it. They didn't start being Christians because it felt good or they liked the community. Those people will drop out eventually. It's the people that realized, that knew, this is true regardless of how I'm doing today or regardless of how people at my church behave. They're the ones that go the distance. So if you're someone who's exploring faith today, maybe that's why you're here this morning, or you've been in church for ages, you identify as a Christian, let me encourage you, do some thinking. It's okay to use your brain. Chat with people. Ask hard questions about what we believe. Because the faith you'll end up with will be more robust and more life-enhancing for it. You've got to know it's true. So the propositional nature of truth is important. It matters. But despite what I've just said, it's not enough on its own. It's not enough on its own. Because if your faith stays in the realm of just propositional truth, it will last the course, it will weather the storms, but it won't be very exciting or joyful. It won't be very exciting or joyful. You need a wider understanding of truth. Because secondly, truth is powerful. It's powerful. It transforms you. Truth that is just information doesn't transform you. The truth that John's talking about isn't just stuff he knows about Jesus in his head. John believes it will actually change people. That third verse again. He says, grace, mercy, and peace, which come from God the Father and from Jesus Christ, the Son of the Father, will continue to be with us who live in truth and love. The truth isn't just something to know in your mind. It's something to be inhabited. It's a way of life. If you live in truth, you operate based on the truth about Jesus. Grace, mercy, and peace will be with you. When you read that sentence, I think it sounds like John has just thrown in some nice spiritual-sounding words. Yeah, we'll pull out grace this time and mercy or peace will do. Stick them in a sentence and it sounds Christian. No, I think he's a lot more deliberate than that. Grace is God's unconditional, not at all deserved favor. Mercy is God's decision not to punish us despite how we all reject him as people in lots of ways. And peace is God's expression of friendship. We're not his enemies because Jesus has made peace between us and God. These are all things, I think deliberately chosen by John when he wrote this, that are experienced in a relationship. The truth about Jesus isn't only facts that we place our trust in. It's the bedrock on which we have a relationship with Jesus where we experience all of these things in relationship and many more. In the same way that I think many people stay Christians because they're totally certain that it's factually true, I also think that many of those same people don't experience all of this stuff, which are the whole point. And that might be you this morning. It might be you. You know Christianity is true. You won't be convinced otherwise. You're settled in. You can explain it, but it all feels dry. It feels dry. You believe in a God who loves you. You believe his son died for you. You know the right answers, and yet God feels distant. And in this line, though, and John does this quite a lot, he pairs truth with love. He pairs truth with love. Truth is brilliant, but it has to be paired with love. And then it becomes powerful and transformative. They're supposed to go together. Love without truth is just meaningless, fuzzy feelings. And truth without love is dry. So the truth John's obsessed with, the truth that he goes on about, isn't supposed to stay as proposition, as facts. It's supposed to be paired with love. Because the truth is supposed to touch your heart. It's supposed to personalize. The truth about Jesus is supposed to move you to love more deeply. Look at that interesting phrase back in verse 1. I don't know if I put it on the screen. Oh, I did. I'm writing to the chosen lady and to her children, whom I love in the truth. Now, there's debate with this letter. Is John writing to a particular woman that he knows and her family? Or is this a sort of code way of writing to a church that was being attacked and it sort of doesn't draw attention somehow? It doesn't matter. The point is, John says that he loves them in the truth. He loves them in the truth. I don't know about you, but I don't talk that way. I don't wake up in the morning and turn to my wife and say, "Darling, I love you in the truth." What John means here is there's something about this truth, there's something about grasping it that changes your affections. He's saying to whoever these people are, I have a love for you that is enhanced by the truth. My love for you is enhanced by the truth. How does that work? If you get really into learning advanced physics or biochemistry, you'll read the textbooks, you'll learn loads of brilliant things, but it won't change how you love people. You'll just know more. But there's something about the truth about Jesus that interferes with your passions at the very deepest level. The more you know him, the more it clicks, the more you get it. The truth will point your affections to loving God more and loving other people more. It will transform you. If you're a follower of Jesus this morning, it is already transforming you. And you'll know that. Third thing is personal. John understands truth to be personal. John is adamant that the message about Jesus is factual, it really happened. He thinks that's when it's grasped, it will captivate your heart. But he goes further, it's personal. Verse 2 is very easy to read over, but think about the magnitude of this. John says, the truth lives in us and will be with us forever. People don't say things like that about stuff they read in a textbook, do they? The truth lives in us and will be with us forever. Now remember who's writing this. This is geriatric John. When Jesus was killed and then rose again and then left, John was in his early 20s. It's been a while. I bet he wished he could see his friend again in the flesh. But he knows. In his old age, John hasn't become grumpy or cynical, like frankly a lot of older people do. He knows that Jesus did it. He was there. He knows that Jesus has transformed him through the truth. But the thing that's given John this amazing lifelong faith is he knows that Jesus still lives in him and always will. So the truth is personal because it's a person. Fundamentally, a truth is a person. In John's gospel, the account this same man wrote about Jesus, he remembers Jesus saying these words, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And it stayed with him. Jesus doesn't just say, I have truth. He says, I am truth. I am truth. Some people may remember when the football manager Jose Mourinho famously said, I am football. Anyone remember that? I think it was a little bit arrogant. He wasn't saying that he was literally a ball made of leather. He was saying, I am the central character in this sport. I'm the main person. It's all about me, is what he was saying. Jesus, with no arrogance, was saying, I am the truth. In other words, I am the defining thing about reality. In the great human quest for meaning and identity, it's not even my teaching, as good as that is. It's actually me, myself, the person that I am. And this is huge because every other view of the world I've ever come across is primarily, you know, a theology, a philosophy, or some sort of system. Marxism, socialism, conservatism, atheism, Buddhism, photojournalism, whatever. Somebody once pointed out, the leading thinkers of all these isms, it doesn't matter if they ever lived or not. It doesn't matter, it's about their ideas. You just take their ideas and you have a go at putting them into practice and see how you get on. But Christianity is all on the person of Jesus, the person. So there are propositional truths about him that matter. It matters whether he lived and died and rose again, really. It matters that the truth is powerful and it transforms people and it's amazing. But more than that, he's a person who thinks and feels and loves and relates to us all personally. And because the truth is a person, Christianity is always personal. Every time. People will debate Christian ideas and theology. People will question whether God exists. People will question, can we trust the Bible? How do we interpret the Bible? All day long. That's all important. But when it comes down to it, you have to contend with the fact that the truth is a person. He's a person. You've got to deal with Jesus. You can't pin him down to a set of ideas. He's not even close to fitting in that box that you've made. And yet, as tricky as that is, it's also really reassuring. If it was about ideas and even Jesus' great teaching, you'd just have to get on with it. Give it a go. Just keep trying to live the right way. But John says, John knows from experience, if Jesus somehow lives in us, oh, you can relax. We don't need to prove ourselves. We don't need to impress anyone. God himself lives in people that know Jesus. That's the key thing that pulls together the propositional and the powerful. That's how you have a faith that stays the course, but is also never boring. It's personal. I reckon many of the problems Christians experience with their faith are when they forget for a moment, or even for a while, that it's all about a person. We get distracted by our questions around theology and feelings and pursuing nice experiences and having good discussions and worship styles and expressing ourselves and our gifts. All important stuff, all got its place, but relatively, it's all small. Relatively, it's all small. I also look around our church and I think some of us are old. No names mentioned. Morning, Paul Wainwright. The rest of us who are not old presumably hope to be so someday. And my question is, what do we want our faith to be like in our old age? It's very easy to make it about the wrong things. It's very easy to become jaded and cynical. Some of us know that temptation very well. How do you avoid that? I think John had something of the answer. He had a faith that fed his brain and touched his heart, but it was always about a person. It was always about Jesus. And we too often forget it's this person that loves us and paid for us and lives in us and wants this relationship with us. That's the truth. That's what John was excited about. It sustained him, it motivated him, and it kept him excited about it even into his old age, even when he saw good and bad things happen, into his old age. Who would not want that to be their faith story? Who would not want to get to the end of their life and look back on their faith story and say it was just like his? Is that not what we all want? Let me pray. Father, thank you for this great little letter. Thank you that the truth that John talks about is true. Thank you that it's propositionally true, but it's powerful, it changes us in our communities. But thank you that it's all centered on that person who we worship today, that we worship every Sunday, Jesus. And please help us, prevent us from making it about the wrong things, from our particular points of view, our politics, our little theological gripes, our preferred worship style, how loud we like the volume of the band, all these things that we feel really matter. Please sweep that away in our hearts collectively and individually. Help us focus it back on it being about that person of Jesus again, Lord. Amen.